Hello, and welcome to another episode of Blue Marble Podcast. I'm your host, Rev Charbert. Thanks for tuning in. Our purpose is to educate and motivate about how to put our nature-centered spirituality into action for the planet and for each other. This time, our featured guest is Dr. Charles Curtin, scientist, activist, and author of a compelling trilogy of books, The Science of Open Spaces, Complex Ecology, and his new release, Beyond Resilience, a book being called one of the most important books of our time. Today, we'll be talking about what's in that book, and it includes the kinds of thinking we need to develop, proactive solutions instead of just reactive solutions, and how that relates to the climate crisis. Charles Curtin earned a PhD in zoology and a Master's of Science in Land Resources, both from the University of Wisconsin. For more about Dr. Charles Curtin, I invite you to go to his website at www.charlescurtin.com. I'm going to spell that, www.charlescurtin.com. Welcome, Charles.
Well, thank you.
Glad to
Appreciate
have
it.
you with us today. So let's just get right to it. In your biography, you mentioned that you were born in London, England, to noted world historian Philip Curtin and journalist Anne Curtin. And you write, I'm quoting here, you say, "I spent much of my formative years in Europe and West Africa, and when not overseas, on a farm in southwest Wisconsin." As someone who is also a fellow traveler for much of my life, I want to ask you, how has your life pattern of traveling, moving through different landscapes, how has that shaped you?
Well, thank you for the question, Charlotte. And my experience really stem from, I think, or the key importance was really being in environments where I wasn't the dominant culture, where things were different than me. So I think I learned at a very early age to expect things to be different. And I think I followed as much the rest of my life. I've lived in rural communities and remote communities, indigenous communities, much of that time. So I'm comfortable being in almost an outsider role where I have that sort of viewpoint from an outsider or an outside perspective. Particularly powerful, I think, is that being a small European boy in colonial West Africa at the close of the colonial period in the mid-60s, I did experience the opposite side of racism, what it's like to be a person, in this case, a person not of color in a colored society. I think it's been very powerful too, from some of my earliest experiences. That ironically remind me a lot of what Martin Luther King describes a boy, of some of the slurs and racism he described. I experienced as a young boy, and I think it helps to give you humility and have a little bit of a taste to what many people on the globe experience every day. And I hope that makes me more sensitive to hearing a variety of viewpoints, perspectives.
I find that I really appreciate your comments about that. And having grown up in a very, very international environment too, it really provides a different perspective that kind of goes with you as you move through different environments, human and natural. You're also a former Nordic ski racer and US ski team member. And you say that spending time in mountains, deserts, or on the ocean is a big part of your life. So how is being out in nature among the wild? How is that a big part of your life?
Yeah, so part of your introduction a minute ago mentioned this farm in southwest Wisconsin. Probably one of the most important experiences for me was being on this farm. And even today, our family sold the farm decades ago, but I go back there and visit. And it's like looking into a mirror. I feel like the landscape is always looking at myself. And so I grew up riding and doing things in the country, being a country kid, and then I was about 16, traded in the horses for skis, and I said seriously ski race for about a decade. And that really, that lifestyle of being active and being out in the environment has been part of my sort of daily activity ever since. And for example, at the moment we live in a remote community in northwestern New Mexico, north central New Mexico, and the mountains are right behind us. The San Cristos stretch up nearly 13,000 feet right behind the house. And that being able to walk out the door is critical because to me, ecology is part of ecology, and I call myself an ecologist, is a science. I mean, often I think during the environmental movement, we got to associate it being a spiritual belief, and it is spiritual and is a lot of other things to different people, but it's also science. But I sense that for being an effective ecologist, being an effective scientist, you have to be in tune with the environment because all science is a way of quantifying what you see. If you can't see it, you can't sense it, and you can't quantify it. And so a lot of what I do is, as a translator, I try and take those spiritual or cultural or environmental perceptions and try and translate them into a way that's testable, that's defensible, because we need to be able to communicate those ideas to a wider group of people. So I may have a great concern over, say, environment, climate change, or what have you. But if I can, if it's just inside me, it's powerful, it's important. But as a communicator, I need to try and communicate that. So science to me is just one more tool. And the other great thing about science, frankly, is when you look at things objectively, often you get surprised. And it's really important to have your underlying assumptions tested and if things not turn out the way you expected. So you may have deep passionate beliefs for one thing, and you may have a simple cause-effect belief, and it may turn out to something entirely different that's causing this. And so it's very important to keep your mind open. And even if you're a non-scientist, find ways to test yourself to make sure you're not just simply, falling victim to one's own biases and preconceived beliefs.
I really appreciate that. I saw a bumper sticker this morning on a car that said, "Don't believe everything you think." And I appreciate what you're saying about science and also developing multiple languages with which to know and test climate change or some of these other issues. And in a day and age where opinion seems to be dominating the airwaves, that seems to be really important to bring multiple languages to the table. Well,
I
now you
understand
will.
exactly. Because, for example, I often work with indigenous cultures, and I find that oftentimes, if I'm getting complex issues like climate change, it's easier to communicate that with indigenous people because they've got ways of thinking about that. Amazing experience years. And by indigenous, it's not always someone who is, say, of Eurasian descent who's moved in this country for, thousands and thousands of years. It can also be people who are Anglo, but have lived on land a long time. It's an amazing experience years ago where I was attending this workshop with physicists at a place called Santhe Institute. We're looking at complex systems and how these things all will function. And about 3 days later, I went and met with a bunch of ranchers on this remote ranch house almost on the Mexican border. And the amazing thing is these ranchers understood complexity and dynamics and environment every bit as well as these physicists, some of whom were Nobel laureates. And yet they didn't have a lexicon. They had different lexicon to talk about, but their intrinsic cultural context allowed to see things in a way that was cutting edge and novel to these physicists, but was just their everyday reality. They lived it, so they understood it.
I love that. Well, and now you're living on a farm. I mean, you've set your root in the mountains of northern New Mexico with your partner, Ilka. Did I say that right?
Yes.
And also a tortoise named Bisque. Yay. So, yet another landscape. How does your connection to the land, the water, the air, the fire affect your work, your beliefs, your values, your spirit?
That's just a great question. I often think about landscapes as having their landscapes and their spiritual landscapes, and I'm sure many folks have places they are deeply connected to, whether it be the Pine Barrens, New Jersey, or coast of California, or wherever you're. And for me, about nearly 40 years ago to the day, I was on a college field course to the Southwest, and I came through New Mexico, and it was like overnight, Memorial Day weekend, or vividly 1984. I entered that weekend as a ski racer and someone who was really interested in Nordic events in the north and snow. And 3 days later, I was a converted desert biologist and was really focused on New Mexico. And it took me about 10 years to get back there. But now for nearly 30 years since, I've spent most of my time in New Mexico because I think there's this deep cultural integrations landscape. I think in some ways there's no accident that both indigenous cultures, and we have 1,000-year-old pueblos a few miles from where I live, also from near where I live is Los Alamos, the birthplace of the bomb. And those kind of different kinds of powerful belief systems are embedded in this landscape. It's a landscape of powerful belief and loss. And so I live in an Hispano indigenous community of 600 people, but one reason I'm here is because the culture, these deep cultural roots are so important for enacting the kind of transformation we're trying to create.
Well, you write that you, and again, I'm quoting you have worked at the nexus of science and policy with a long-term interest in environmental change, large-scale socio-ecological experiments and program design. And through working in a diversity of areas, such as you've been talking about, you say the bulk of my professional practice is focused on developing community-based solutions to large and complex environmental challenges. Well, I'm thinking about the environment you just described. It's complex. Do you want to tell us about some of those solutions?
Yes. So I arrived in Mexico now nearly 30 years ago as a postdoc doing large-scale climate studies. And I quickly find that to get the science right, you had to get the policy right. To get the policy right, you had to get the culture right. You really had to understand that. So, for example, I was very fortunate early on to connect with a group called the Malpai Borderlands Group that were a collaborative of ranchers doing very creative work, decades before the time. And they in turn were linked with Maasai in East Africa and all sorts of pastoralists around the globe. And what that really showed was that the old sort of bias that, oh, ranchers are a bunch of rednecks, they only cared about cows and care about the environment. And they really threw that whole understanding on its head and really changed, realized that local people could be amazing stewards of the land. And it's funny because a lot of these folks were very, very, very conservative politically, and yet we found we had this common ground. So I guess where this led me to think about, first of all, is looking for common ground, thinking about where, so often, even today, we think about we may have 90% in common in terms of what we care about. We care about our families, care about children, care about a lot of things. And yet we focus on 10% we disagree on. And so increasingly try and focus on what do you agree on? What's the common ground? We're not gonna, so yeah, a lot of my collaborators are way on the far right end of the spectrum. I'm probably more the left end of the spectrum, but yet we can find common ground because we can, again, we focus on what we care about, not the things we could fight about. So that, I guess, so really goes down to is thinking about these large scale experiments. In this case, what I mean by that is it began with doing these 10,000 acres manipulations where we bring in cattle, we bring in fire, bring in prairie dogs, look at how that affects climate change. But then I realized, as I mentioned earlier, to get the policy right, you really need to understand it. So we went to much more social experiments, looking at millions of acres or across the Western Atlantic and the Gulf of Maine, working with indigenous peoples in the Middle East, okay, much, much larger scale, recognizing that ultimately it's that social context that drives this. And so like these days, even though I'm trained as an ecologist, even though I have my mind works as an ecologist, I work mostly with minority or indigenous cultures because that's where I feel I can get the most traction, the most understanding, and really use that framework to shift how we think about conservation and global change.
So before we go on, can you say more about how the indigenous groups you're working, how you get more traction with certain groups? Is it because you're
Okay.
able to find more in common about what it is you all care about? Or help me understand that a little more.
Oh, that's a great question. Yeah. So I think it comes a little back to my comment earlier about the physicists versus the ranchers. Our Western society is very linear. It's very, and I should say Western is not a reflection of skin color. It's a reflection of deep time in the land. Like I said, it can be, I think ranchers, some of them who may be hardcore Trump supporters and very politically conservative, after eight generations on the land, can have these deep affinities to that land. And that's what you look for, that connection. So in this case, as I'm pitching ideas or trying to find places to get traction with communities, for example, Taos Pueblo is a few miles from here, and sometimes I find, well, okay, I really need to sit down and talk to people at Taos Pueblo and talk to them what their ideas are, because they're just naturally in sync because they've been a part of the land for so long. Just like as a small boy, having grown up on a farm in Wisconsin, it started me on that path too of being around environment. So I think a lot of it is that in Western society or maybe urban society, a lot of that sensitivity gets closed off. It's like that ability to see and feel is lost when you're detuned, and so that these indigenous groups see things. Also, the whole time frame is so different. They talk about seven generations. That's very true. And this is not just, by the way, indigenous peoples, but again, ranchers and many farmers and folks also are thinking men are generations out. Talk to fishermen, same way, who think many generations out, think beyond the short term. And that's so important because our policy process is largely driven by election cycles. Election cycles are, 2 to 6 years, basically. Well, that's crazy, our short way term way of looking at things. Equally part of that is our funding cycles. We've got typical funder will fund a project 3 to 5 years maximum. So, but our problems take decades, sometimes centuries to fix. So again, that indigenous perspective is very helpful because if I, as a Northern European descent person, reach out to groups, they don't see past my, the sort of body suit I'm wearing. But if I bring in indigenous and diverse other people, they can hear things that they wouldn't necessarily hear just from me. Years ago, when I was working with this Malpai Borderlands group, we used to call it the big hats and cowboy hats, sorry, baseball caps and cowboy hats perspective, where a scientist would walk into a congressional office and they'd sort of nod and agree. And a rancher might walk into that office and agree. And maybe a Maasai tribesman would walk into an office and they might nod and agree. But if you have, a rancher from New Mexico or the Southwest, a scientist, and let's say a Maasai tribes person or someone from the Middle East all walk in or all send the same message, it has incredible power that it wouldn't for any one of these groups. So the critical thing is to move beyond and to bring these diverse cultures and coalitions together. It has much more power. And that's why, again, we really need to move beyond. And again, in some cases, the language of science is very powerful, it's very useful. In the policy realm, we have to defend every word. But other times, I can spend, years developing the data, or indigenous people can just say, this is our reality, this is what we experience. And you can't fight, you can't argue with that. That's their reality. They have, say, 20, 30 generations on the land. And that's equally powerful, maybe more powerful. And so, again, by working across cultures to span this message, it not only increases the power of the message, equally important, the cultures get to understand each other better and to work across, across the sort of cultural and ecological landscape.
I'm so appreciating what you're saying about that. And I know I'm holding off before I move on to the next question there, but what I'm reflecting on as you speak is what you said is striking, is that policy tends to be driven by election or funding cycles, and the coalitions, the People's Climate Movement, as it's been developing as a movement, climate justice movement, is so exciting because it is intersectional and wildly multi cultural and diverse. And it's really, when I hear you say indigenous, I'm thinking of people of place, people who have really come to love a place. And nature is more kin or whatever. But I mean, they have a deep connection to place and an investment in that place remaining sustainable, thriving. And that's very different. This happened to me when I was in Wyoming for a year. I was working with women and domestic violence, that kind of thing. But I found that the ranchers, the long-term ranchers in Wyoming, were deeply connected to place. And the people who were coming in from out of state, working in the mines and had the drill, baby drill mindset and just extractive and exploitative, were not people from that place. But looking at Wyomingite ranchers, people could easily assume things, So those coalitions you're building are really important. And
That's a great phrase, people of place. Like that really is, that's a much better descriptor than indigenous or Hispanic or anything. And because, yeah, exactly. You have to be from somewhere and you have to care about deeply to have that long-term vision. I think we've got such a mobile society, we've kind of lost that. Even people who have moved to rural communities with the best of intentions, often I see us in New Mexico where since, and across the amount in the West, since COVID, there's just we've this huge influx of people from the coast trying to find solace in these remote rural communities, and more power to them. I mean, I get it, but yet they don't yet have those connections. It takes a long time to get there, and some people can able to adapt and listen and engage, but it does mean that yeah, it's hard unless you can very rapidly find those deep connections and deep understanding, which means, listening more than talking.
And it makes me wonder too if some of the extractive industries like mining, like fossil fuels, like big agriculture don't find a lot of benefit in having transient populations of workers coming in seasonally. I mean, it economically makes sense, but you don't have people who are invested in that place. Less likely to be resistance. Anyway, so you've written this trilogy of books, which, as you say, explore this intersection of ecology and culture. And have focused on how the world's messiness leads to uncertainty and unexpected outcomes and what to do about it. I'm going to imagine everyone listening can appreciate the messiness and the uncertainty that you're talking about. A lot of us live it and feel it, and we're eager to hear about what to do about it. So.
Oh, thank you. One quick sort of addition to what you said at the outset of the program, the third book in the trilogy, Beyond Resilience, is now in press, but it won't be out probably to early next year, and that's Johns Hopkins University Press. Just so if you go looking for it now, you won't find it for 6 months or so.
So, to interrupt you though, if people want to keep tabs on that, if they go to your webpage, www.charlescurtin.com, they'll be able to see when it's released.
Yes, exactly. And keep
Got it.
track of the books and writings and the related writings too, yes. So the book is called Beyond Resilience because I realized I discovered, resilience has been a word or phrase that's really caught hold in the last 2 years. I remember being really thought of, knew a real resilience had arrived when I was visiting my mother's retirement home a few years ago. And there in the basement was a preschool, and the preschoolers had a whole wall developed to resilience. And all the what it meant to everyone, you picture their grandfather or whatever. I'm gonna start making a bold statement that resilience is not unimportant, but we're almost as outlived as usefulness. And why I say that is that our world is changing so fast that we can't really resilience basically means it comes is based from a Latin, which means to shirk from or spring back. It's like imagine a slinky, or you pull a slinky and you let go, it snaps back. Or people picture a bridge swinging, like these pictures, Golden Gate Bridge and the storm swinging and then gradually go back to that center set point. That was a beautiful image. And at the height of the conservation environmental movement in the 60s and early 70s, it made a lot of sense. But these days, the world is just changing so fast, we can't go back there. One of my most valued mentors, a guy named John Cairns, who was one of the sort of founders of restoration ecology, said a few years ago that we can't do restoration anymore. There's so much the world has changed. But it's important, though, not to also be have a defeatist attitude or let that depress one or cause negative inaction, because something's changed doesn't mean it necessarily is going to be worse. We need to be very strategic in how we think about the environment, recognizing, okay, given that the climate has changed, what do we do to address that? Let's not ignore it. And I know for me, it's been really radically brought about because much of my work is a radically experienced. My work's been around fire, and 30 years ago, I was working with groups. We were trying to restore fire to landscape because we need to create a mixture of habitats now. And at that point, I should say climate change, instead of scholars study climate change, was sort of this vague. You kind of see it here and there a little bit, but it was subtle. Now it's so in your face. It's just, every day pick up the news. It's arrived that it's here. And so that for some of us who've been around climate change for decades, we keep waiting for it to arrive, and then just said it's here. And so part of that reframing is around this word, which is not new, but I turn more think about this term of not resilience but prosilience. Prosilience comes from this 19th century philosopher named Coleridge, who talked about that you don't shirk from or shrink back like in resilience, but you leap forth. You leap forward. And so the idea is that we need to have boldness right now. We not don't need to keep clinging on to the past that may have changed, but think said boldly about what we need to have happen. I'll give you an example. Here in New Mexico, where our farm is, we suffered the largest fire in New Mexico history. Nearly 400,000 acres burned, and it's just little burnt sticks all around us here. And but it's incredible tragedy. But at the same time, fire is a natural part of the process. But we can look at this two ways. A resilience framing says, oh, if the fire happened, let's plant more trees, let's get back to where the forest was before the fire. Well, the problem is that the temperature is too warm. These ponderosa pines don't grow here very well anymore. The landscapes change, environments change. So you can, I sometimes some simply say that a lot of our policies essentially are focused on recreating the process that created mega fire in the first place. So let's not create mega fire. If it's warm or drier, let's try something different. And that is, if you take a prosilient approach and say, well, it's interesting. A century or more ago, the indigenous and Espanol people in this landscape had a fire-adapted landscape. They had fields, they had grazing areas, they had this mosaic because they lived with fire. So let's not recapture landscape that's occurred circa 1970 or 80 and it's led to the current conditions. Let's look at landscape circa 1880, 1900, and create this diverse matrix of landscapes, because it's not all bad. For example, with the our forests were about 100% historic dan stand down. I'm sorry, 100 times historic stand densities. In other words, we had 100 times more trees than occurred at the time of Northern European settlement. Now with the fires much more open. Well, what that's meant is those trees use water. And so now a lot of streams and areas are coming back. Well, that's the opportunity. We can get more rural agriculture, we get more grazing, get more other benefits. So again, rather than clinging to the past, let's look at the future. And there's always that standard famous stuff, quote by Alexander Graham Bell. I think Helen Keller may have said this too, which is, often as things change, people are looking, as the door closes, looking longingly at what's left rather than what's ahead of them. And again, there's so much opportunity. And it's not to say that it would be better if climate change didn't happen, because yeah, it'd be a lot better if climate change didn't happen. But given that's here, let's be prosilient, let's be proactive and not reactive, and think about what's the vision we want? What do we want to see? Given the current realities of a warmer, drying climate, what do we want to see in 30 years, in 40 years, in 50 years, 100 years? And how do we work toward creating that vision rather than spending, as I've seen around here post-fire, millions or billions of dollars spent on creating something that can't exist anymore because the climate and everything has changed too much?
Aren't we just sort of, not sort of, but aren't we talking about a form of adaptation then? It's like saying if we can't prevent climate change, we can work on trying to mitigate some of the worst impacts of it, which were in some ways, as you're describing, based on the way things were before the event. And rather than trying to recreate the way things were before the event, we're trying to do something that's helping us adapt to a changing climate, landscape, environment, ecology. So I mean, when I'm thinking the term resilience, I work in healthcare, and from a therapeutic perspective, it's what you say. It's like we're trying to return to some kind of divine normal, some sort of ground of well-being, some sort of place of normalcy. But there are things in life that make it that change what that normalcy is, what the new normal is going to be. And so having heard that, is there anything else you want to say about this term beyond resilience?
One thing that I'd say, and you raised a point about adaptive, my perspective is increasingly that it's not adaptive. Because adaptive means we just kind of make do with what is. I would say we're trying to evolve. So we're trying to create a system. This, of course, when natural systems and social systems are incredibly powerful at evolving. And, for both good and bad, and you can evolve, you can argue our society evolved incredibly with the advent of the iPhone. I mean, it can be used for good, used for bad, but we're evolving. So given that reality, the iPhone's probably great, or the internet's a great, metaphors for what we're talking about, climate. Again, it's here. We can't stick the bean genie back in the bottle, but with it here, what are we going to do about that? And so again, so I'd say we're trying to evolve, we're trying to develop evolving systems. So a lot of what this book, Beyond Resilience, is about is, as you alluded to, how do we design a social system that have evolutionary capacity, that can evolve, that can move, that can leap forward? And that is not a trivial undertaking. There's a lot of strategy. And ironically, what I found, I never would have dreamed this, most of the literature I really read and find most useful is not environmental literature. Environmental literature I find to be quite conservative, and sort of hidebound. It's ironically, a lot of the business literature leaders, guys like Ray Dalio from Blackwater Associates, others, you pick up one of the books and you just open to a random page in the middle, you think it was a Taoist text. It's interesting how a lot of business leaders are really thinking in a way that's way beyond where the social environmental changes. And so that's partly a matter of thinking, again, of not being biased, say, well, those guys are businessmen. They're just money grubbing fools. We're not going to listen to them. Say, well, gosh, these guys put a lot of thought into this. And so that's ironic, is that to me, business is asking questions that environmental social activism usually isn't, which is not how do we change or adapt to whatever the external forces, climate change, whatever it be. They're asking, how do we up our game? How do we do what we do better? And I don't see many people asking that. A key part of that, by the way, is ethics. It's interesting that in the business world, there's a lot of talk about ethics. In fact, your typical MBA student will have classes in ethics. I've never seen a course in ethics in environmental movement or ecology. We don't think about it because we assume we know the answer. We assume we know it's right. And to be honest, we usually don't. Or often don't. So again, to me, this book, how I frame it, I start with a long chapter on ethics. More and more I think about ethics and integrity. It's interesting, Buckminster Fuller, who many of you may know, is this amazing polymath, incredible thinker. He did Geodesic Dome and Earth, was it Spaceship Earth? All his ideas were Buckminster Fuller. And,
Spaceship Earth, yeah.
and Buckminster Fuller, essentially, he near the end of his life, he had a stroke, and he was in a coma for many weeks, and he emerged from the coma, and he said, and he devoted the last couple of years of his life to one thing, and one thing only, that's integrity. He said, integrity is both design integrity, in other words, are things aligned, elements aligned, but also ethical integrity. And that's really what this current book is about, is recognize that we really need to think about first our internal integrity. Are we operating from a place of ethics? And second, if we're operating a place of ethics, how do we align that with everything else? So, for example, how do we align what we say with what we do, how we act, how we react with others? And so, to me, more and more, it's about thinking about the interior of how where we are. So, again, for me, I'm trained as a scientist, but I've realized more and more, it's what's interior to me that really makes a difference. I can have the best, most sophisticated science or supercomputers in the world, but if I'm not operating from a place of integrity and a place of honest inquiry and opening understanding, the best supercomputer in the world isn't going to make that difference. And that's why, again, that reality check, working with indigenous and local people and listening and learning from them, is so important in grounding everything else we do.
Well, I'm appreciating as I listen to you. We hear another phrase all the time for a while now, saying the climate crisis is a global crisis. It's an existential crisis, and that's usually spoken in terms of it's an existential threat to our species. But What I'm appreciating about what you just said, again, thinking of it from a therapeutic standpoint, an existential crisis is being out of touch with our own deepest internal truth, as well as being out of touch with anything transcendent beyond ourselves, you know. So it's like, and not having that connectedness. So, like you say, if we're out of touch with our own integrity, with our own internal guidance system, our own sense of internal ethics, which is such a huge part of spirituality, then it's an individual crisis as much as it is a species crisis.
Yeah,
And yeah, yeah,
that's
and
exactly it. Because we've got the science, we know what we need to do. It's not able to do it, and it's not going to be exactly existential pointing over and saying, "Oh, that guy there." I mean, for I've got friends who are very eminent senior scientists who are on these global panels of the UN and whatnot around climate change. What they do is they get on a plane, they fly to Borneo or wherever, and their climate footprint is staggering. And I look at these guys and go, how can you preach? They say, okay, well, I'm doing good work, so I can get on a plane. But this guy going to surf in Bali, he, that that's he's being immoral, but I'm being moral. Well, no,
Yeah,
take a look
right.
at what's behind it, behind what's driving you. Could you do
Yeah.
this a different way? And that's the thing. The problem is, again, as I said, I think we in environmental and spiritual communities are working with around the environment. Take a long, hard look at ourselves and think about, because we can always shift the blame. We can always blame Russia or General Motors or whoever. But take a look, hard look at ourselves and what can we do? And if enough of us make a difference, those guys are going to follow.
Well, and it's also a matter of really paying attention to your internal guidance system, nurturing it, putting responsible information into it, but also drawing upon emotional intelligence, natural intelligence, intrapersonal intelligence, as people of place so often will, because it's been said often, there's nothing more that needs to be known from the climate science. We understand. But so much of the challenge today, and we're in an election year, but it's not just in America, it's not just this year, is the enormous amount of disinformation, greenwashing, gaslighting that's going on. And we can't rely upon that to know what we need to know, because we all know. And so, yeah, the climate crisis, it's an existential crisis. And it's the movement is hugely intersectional, as we've said. It affects every aspect of our lives and the lives of every living thing on our planet, the planet itself. And as part of the climate crisis, we are looking at increased social disruption, destabilization, national insecurity, absolutely, if not complete collapse of civilizations. I don't mean to sound alarmist, but these things are being talked about, you know. And so the climate crisis, it's a human social crisis, it's a societal crisis. So, to your work, you know, what is the kind of institution or internal thinking needed to develop proactive rather than reactive solutions to these societal challenges that are happening?
Now that really is the crux of
Small
it.
question.
Yeah, right, exactly. We have how long? Right.
Yeah.
But I guess to me, to boil down, we started to touch on a minute ago that, like I said, environmental scientists have spent more and more time looking at social systems. And the way I think about it is that we really got to look again at the integrity of our social institution. That means really looking at the ethics, looking at principles. I, in this forthcoming book and actually some earlier books, I talk about principles. You can go through and look at things like, are you being open and transparent with the people you're working with and with yourself? Are you reaching out to diversity of cultures? Who's, has access to the system? Those kinds of things. So it's, again, it's really thinking about institutions, because ultimately climate change, as I said, it's existential, but it's also created by us. It's created by our institutions. Great examples, things like the way we fund so much for science and policy. The way donors work is, I describe it as, it's a zero-sum game. Basically, in my career, I've watched more and more people chasing fewer dollars in terms of funders and grant and other opportunities. And what happens then is that as you get more people chasing fewer dollars, it becomes much more competitive. And so you need to move beyond being competitive to being integrative. And that means getting more resource in the system. And while you can say, well, gosh, maybe we should tax wealthy people or something, the reality is that, again, it starts with you. So, for example, increasingly, even though I've lived in the nonprofit world for much of my career, more and more I'm working on carbon sequestration and carbon balance and using actually burn trees to create biochar to then create restoration and create carbon credits. And so using business state, for example, principles, because collaboration is beautiful. It's amazing when it works, but it's really, really tough. I think we all know how hard it is to sometimes have agreement or find common ground with our partner or family. Well, now try and find common ground or partnership with 100 people, 1,000 people. It's tough. So while you want to do that and need to pursue that, there are times when that's not necessarily possible. I mean, for example, here in New Mexico, post-fire, we've got literally millions of dollars that Congress and the president have allocated, nearly $5 billion of fire restoration. You pour that much money into the system and it's just going to warp it because people begin thinking about dollars, not about long-term effects. So you can fight it by trying to create collaborators in the face of huge influx of destructive forces like tons of money. Or you can harness it and move with it and flow with it. In this case, we're trying to channel it by creating sort of micro corporations that do carbon sequestration and use the market forces toward our ends. And of course, it's not an either or question. You want to do both. But the idea, again, is being very open-minded and realize that, okay, if I want to do something that's going to take me 30 years to accomplish, and I know that the donors are only going to typically be interested for 2 to 5 years, don't pick the 2 to 5 year solution. I have to take something different. So ironically, I've come to think of often corporate structures being one of the real opportunities here to think about how do we create self-funding, self-sustaining systems? Because if you're at the mercy of donors and of external forces, like an existential forces, it's a hard slog. And it doesn't mean you don't want to do that, but you also want to try and harness market forces. So in my work, I have a for-profit arm, which is they looks at how we create these micro corporations harness carbon credits. I have a nonprofit arm. So the San Cristo Mountain Initiative is my nonprofit arm where I bring together indigenous and Hispanic people to create holistic place-based solutions. But I realize that's why we move so fast. And if I want to really move fast and address certain issues, I also have to have this this for-profit arm called Pyrocene Solutions, where we're actually looking at very rapid ways of addressing these issues. Again, harnessing climate forces in real time to address these issues. So again, to me, it comes back to really thinking about institutions and taking this hard look and asking hard questions like, are our institutions up to the task? And I would argue that at least in the 30 years I've been doing this work, the gap between our institutions and what we need to do keeps getting greater and greater and greater and greater, and that a lot of the climate change issues are an institutional failure as much as anything else. And so we need to rethink how we do that work. And again, being very pragmatic, and I'll repeat what I said a minute ago, donors fund things for 2 to 5 years. Our problems take at least 20 years to solve. So right there's a disconnect. So you got to go, oh, well, I could ignore the reality and, or I can think about that reality and think about how I'm going to address it.
Well, I hear you sounding very, very entrepreneurial, and a lot of larger institutions like the marketplace. I hear a lot of people saying, oh, the marketplace is what's going to save us. But if capitalistic institutions in the marketplace are not moving quickly enough, a lot of income, not income as in money, but coming in is a whole new market space for a lot of entrepreneurs doing very innovative things. But what about moonshots? I mean, we're being told by science that we have a decade in which to do anything, should I say proactive or resilient? Maybe that's not right. That takes a moonshot. But if some of these other projects are taking, what do we do with the window we have here?
Well, my
Sorry, I'm throwing
sense
that
is that
question at you.
we're investing billions in moonshots, and yet the work on the ground, the solid stuff we know how to do, we know works, is starving. And so if we took a fraction of moonshots and put into communities and put into ecological and economic work, for example, there's increasingly there's development around regenerative economies and circular economies, and really thinking about
Yes.
how to develop those. And if you couple that with there's a long history of co-ops. So while what I'm focused on is the idea of conservation co-ops, I mean, back in the height of the Dust Bowl, one way we solved that was the farmers got together and created these co-ops, and they bunched together to use equipment and to work together. And so to me, the co-op mentality is, that's kind of that blend of entrepreneurial with the community cultural. One of the best examples is the Mondragon system, the Mondragon co-ops, which in Franco, Spain, the Basque people were being persecuted and were being downtrodden and being destroyed. And this very insightful priest said, we need to empower people through creating corporations. Corporations, though, where they serve the people, not the dollar. And the Mondragon, is now, I think, one of the top, its most productive corporations in Europe. And yet, and while you could argue that something's been lost in that translation, just like maybe the ag co-ops begun in the 30s, become very big in this country. Yeah, I think they're on to something. So to me, we don't want to not do some, we think we do need to try some moonshots. But to me, there's also a lot of this basic, we're just not doing a lot of the basic. We kind of know what doesn't work because we're doing it. Yeah, we keep doing it. Against that Einstein code about, death and insanity, is to try the same thing again and again. So we're trying models like traditional nonprofits, like academic institutions that don't really fit the purpose. I mean, for example, in academia, those papers, and I know I was in academia, I lived in that world, but their primary goal is to get tenure. Their probable goal is not to solve climate change. So how do you change the rules to create incentives? Likewise, in the nonprofit world, nonprofits may be incredibly passionate, well-meaning people, but they've got, when you have more people chasing fewer dollars, it becomes kind of this Hunger Games or gladiator ring arena where people are duking it out, and the best person wins. Well, it's not the best, it's the best given the limited understanding we have this moment. So again, it creates resilience rather than prosilience. So to me, I guess I'd say moonshots are not maybe technology. Moonshots are in terms of prosilience, of leaping forth, of trying strategies. And I'll give them my work, for example. My book I talk about, I've probably done 50 different projects over the last 30 years. They're all little experiments. I'll work with fishermen in Maine and try this, and this worked. That didn't work with, indigenous people in East Africa. This worked, that didn't. Middle East. My current work, it's taken us me 5 years and probably 30 tries to get to the point where I am now. But the idea is to learn and evolve. And that's what you have to do, is you're testing, you're experimenting, because you're not going to get that moonshot. That moonshot, the result of, a lot of trial and error to get to the point where you do that leap. And yeah, that's one of the brilliant things to talk about in the business literature. Something like the iPhone was not, that was years of work that got them to the point. People at Bell Labs talking about describing the iPhone in the late 60s. Took them 40 years to get there where they actually created. Well, likewise, today we need a lot of small experiments where people learn from each other and they evolve and adapt. And then once they've learned, and I should and to evolve, then they can do those leaps. But you first have to do a lot of trial and error. And again, that means really rethinking about the way we do work. And again, something business figured out, that for every moonshot, for every successful big payoff, there are 50 failures. I love the example of, it turns out that the Babe Ruth, his best home run season, I'm not a baseball fan, but I love the analogy, 1927. Turned out Babe Ruth, the best baseball hitter of all time, struck out, I think it's 5 out of 7 times. Well, imagine in our nonprofit or academic world, if you struck out 5 out of 7 times, you're out of job. But you know, a lot of corporations get that. A lot of other folks get that it takes, you need to have a patience for risk. But intelligence risk and risk where you learn. And that's maybe the final point, maybe I'll leave people in terms of the book, that it's about learning and evolving, taking risks. But you again, you've evolved from it, you learn from it, you adapt from it, and you say, oh, okay, well, I tried this strategy, it didn't work. Here are the reasons why I'm going to try this. So for us, for example, I began 5 years ago in this corporate path of looking at biochar and carbon credits. The market crashed. I went into working collaboratives. I worked a number of collaborative projects with local people. We've developed a lot of common ground. But I realized that model's gone as far as it can. Now I'm stepping back and doing the carbon piece, bringing on a lot of the local people. So, for example, one of my biggest funders and supporters is a group called Chicanos por la Causa. That was a California-based Hispanic rights organization begun in the 70s, but they see it, they get it. Well, I wouldn't have been able to get Chicanos por la Causa to support carbon credits if I hadn't done the legwork to reach out to this community. So again, all that integration strategy comes together.
So really paying attention to who are the stakeholders involved, having a growth mindset, thinking outside the box, being willing to take risks, gaining practical wisdom from the trial and error risk-taking, maybe changing up your stakeholders on the ground as you go. I see that that's a community building, society building way of finding ecological solutions. And it also, while I'm listening to that, makes it clear to me why it's so often frustrating for activists who are trying to move policy forward, because policy requires leaders and politicians who will willingly take risk. And so often we know, even though we put them in office to manage risk management, they so often will not take enough risk to allow themselves to trial and error and move forward, or even to change up the stakeholders if they're not involved in getting them reelected. Yeah,
Yeah,
complicated.
so
So in a
yeah,
lot of ways, yeah.
because it's
Well,
act so much for activism is sort of applying 19th century ideals to 21st century problems. We've got this arms race of evolving things going on, and while yeah, a lot of the nonprofit world and activists have internet and all this new technology,
we're
their actual
digital.
ways of operating are pretty antiquated. Are sort and that's the thing, and there are a lot of people in these areas of institutional thinking in academia and elsewhere, and it doesn't matter whether you can read, let's say everything from, Buddhist teachings to the Dalai Lama to, cutting edge science thinking. All these things have something to contribute, and they all align. And you look for that alignment again, that integrity. Where when I look around, I see if the Dalai Lama and let's say Ray Dalio and say a couple of climate scientists and indigenous people all say the same thing, go, oh gosh, that's a place to head. But that's the other thing you said. Really, it is so much of, to me, our science and our activism is just lagging decades behind where a lot of the problems are. We really haven't fundamentally changed the way we've done activism since, I don't know, 56, and yet the world is very different. So we need to really rethink how we do that. And that again, it's not doing more, it's doing, do more better.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting to see what the digital ecology is doing to stuff when it comes to activism. But
Yes.
and we're talking about some really, big systemic kinds of issues. And I'm imagining that some of our listeners right now, might be listening and feeling overwhelmed because cognitive fatigue is real. People feel like they're constantly being asked to hold these huge issues that are bigger than what they personally can affect or control, and it can be depressing or just overwhelming. And so I'm wondering, if you can suggest, what are some of the most helpful things an individual might do to be supporting a resilient way of moving forward, you know, something that's hopeful or empowering.
Well, I've been struck by how my career, where I've got the most traction, is often when I've worked with local community groups, because they come. I look for models. So, for example, this Malpa group, Borderlands group I mentioned, the current work within with a new coalition of Hispanic indigenous people. All these are models, and so I'd say one of the big game changers these days is that someone, you know, sitting in their bedroom in Cincinnati can move a message around the world. Just you need a compelling message, right? So focus on a compelling message. Look what you can do, you know, whether it be in Cincinnati or Wyoming or Alaska or New York, wherever, you know, make a difference in your community, create a model, create a vision, and then communicate that out. And so percolate around the globe as you spread that. So that to me is really been a great leveler. And that, you know, remote indigenous community in East Africa or Navajo country or wherever can operate, maybe even outcompete in the cultural space, much larger forces, because there's such an appetite for that. So to me, it's, you know, work on what you can work on, not what you can't. Focus on common ground, not on differences. And then, you know, find exciting, innovative solutions that make you want to get up in the morning, that make you can't wait to do. And with my work, you know, I can't wait to get up the next morning and see what else is going to happen. And a lot of it, sometimes it's going to be pretty, you know, rough and tumble. And just a joke of my students, conservation is a blood sport. It's very physical. It's very political. And yet, that's also part of the, you don't want to be afraid of that, but also recognize that there's a lot of excitement to be able to create differences. So that to me is, you don't have to be head of a multinational or you know, be in the UN or I don't know, a congresswoman or something to make a difference. This day, what we have not yet really harnessed as well as we can is a good story is a good story. And you know, listen to BBC, NPR, and entities like this one, and you know, create a good story, create something that excites you, and then get out there and promote the heck out of it in a way that lets other people know, that catalyzes them. Just like this group of ranchers I mentioned, where they thought they were the last of generation of ranchers, this is the Malpai Borderlands group. They thought their livelihoods and land were over. And then 5 years later, there are people all over the globe who are talking about how exciting this group of ranchers, very conservative people, but yet created a new vision that spread across the country, across the West, across the globe. There, I've run into people, you know, I mean, you know, pastoralists from Mongolia who got excited about what these conservative ranchers did in New Mexico and Arizona. So again, we need to create more of those kinds of models, and that's where I think there's immense opportunity for people. But again, that requires not doing what, oh, say, oh, this rancher group did this 30 years ago, no, or this group did this 5 years ago, no. Look today, now, what can you do? What are the constraints, and how do you get around them? And I think, again, it's about asking, what does stop us? What prevents you? Okay, if it's vision, you're excited, you're so enthusiastic, you want to create this difference, see great need. What's stopping? Okay, now what do you need to do about it?
And this is kind of taking this in a place where I didn't expect it to go, but you are underscoring for me again the power of story. The power of story, and of course, in a digital age, we have the platforms and opportunities to share stories so much more broadly. And when I think about, you mentioned indigenous or people of place, nature, spirituality, it so much features oral tradition, the sharing of our story, our human story together, the story of the earth, our interconnectedness with all of that, our excitement about what is happening now and what we can do now. And I think that that is something I would want to encourage everyone listening to do, is to, as you say, be excited about a solution around you. Be excited about some solution that's happening around you. Connect with it. Tell your story. of trying it, tell your impact story of a climate impact that you had and what's happening that people are doing around it. But find your voice and use your voice and share your voice with others. That's something any of us can do, and every voice matters. Would you agree?
I totally agree. And also I'd add to that, that at least my career, the more audacious, the better. I mean, within reason, obviously you don't want to, do things that make, defy laws of physics. But ironically, where I failed most spectacularly in my career is when I was being, I thought, conservative and practical. That's like the death knell. What you want instead, I think, is be, yeah, practical. Yeah, think about the underlying principles. That's why principles are important. But then after that, think about, yeah, what is that story? What's that vision? And dare to be audacious. Is that's again, those are the moonshots that you referred to earlier. And it's exciting. It's not going to probably, it's like a Babe Ruth. You're not getting a home run every time. But if you don't try, we're beyond trying to base hits. That's not a good use of time. And yeah, so exactly. Pick something that excites you, that's innovative, that is cutting edge. And I said it's and this is not just going to be look across the business realm. I guess Ray Dalio talked about, he talks about audaciousness, lean to audaciousness, lean to audaciousness, and this cycle of audaciousness. And that's what, that's what the top corporations of the globe have figured out years ago. We haven't figured it out. We're still doing base hits in the conservation world for the most part. There are exceptions, of course, but we need to have that. Get an entrepreneur, as you call it, mindset of trying things, recognizing that failure is the quickest way to learn, and then moving forward from that.
So we can all have a batting average. Not
Yeah,
acceptable
exactly. Yeah.
batting. It's not 7 out of 10, but get excited, try something, tell the story of trying it, get on board with others trying it. We don't have to invent it, but get in with it. Get in with it.
Yeah. And
Yeah.
figure probably you're likely to do better than Babe Ruth.
That's great. So final words, last words that you would You what you know when I'm thinking about this generation on, because everything is still on our watch, and the next generation, any final words of hope or encouragement or
Oh, I think that, I forget who was to say you'll be cursed to live in interesting times, but certainly that's the case here. But I sense that humanity has never faced such threats, but it's never faced such opportunity. I mean, it's we're an amazing time. And we could look back in 50 or 100 years and see people could say, my God, look at these guys. They brought it right to the edge and look what they did. Look what they did with this. And that takes, I guess, a lot to me boils down to courage. And courage
courage.
is a matter of vision. And so it's a matter of not being afraid to make that leap. But I really, to me, I'd say that, sure, one can look around and see, the Arctic and various things, melting sea ice and whatnot. But I prefer to look at the opportunity on the ground, like I mentioned before, the ability to say restore indigenous and Hispano and local agriculture in our region to create fire mitigation. That's incredibly exciting. There are all sorts, every community's got something like that they can be doing. And I think that's the human condition, the nature of humanity is we don't act until we're really up against it. But you look at many of the most exciting things been done. There's a lot of suggestion that the whole way of innovation, our current social structures emerged during the Ice Age when we were a period of collapse and humanity was down to just a handful of people. And out of that sprung all these creative endeavors we do today, a lot of them. But yet, there's of course a lot of baggage too from that time period that we need to move beyond. But yeah, that'd be my main point to people is that, yeah, we're this is exciting. It's an immense opportunity. We that means just take every day waking up thinking, oh, what can you do? How can you do it differently? How can you learn? How can you evolve? And recognizing that it's not that, yeah, everything being equal, rather we didn't have climate change, but it's here. So as are the institutions and technologies we're living with today. So how do we harness that as best we can?
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank
I'm not
you.
going to say anything else after that because that was well said, beautifully said. And folks, so that concludes this episode of Blue Marble Podcast. I want to thank you so much, Dr. Charles Curtin, for sharing your story, your resources, and more about your work. And as you've said, if people want to stay abreast, to stay in tune with your book releases, the books you've already done, but when Beyond Resilience is released, you can always go to Dr. Charles Curtin's website, which is www.charlescurtin.com. That's Curtin. Again, www.charlescurtin.com. Thank you to our audience for tuning in. Folks, if you value what you've been hearing here today, please share this information with others. Share the story. You can find recordings of these programs available for listening and downloading by going to the Circle Sanctuary website at circlesanctuary.org. You just look under the Our Work tab, and you'll find all Blue Marble podcasts under Circle Sanctuary Network podcasts with links to current and past podcasts. Or you can go directly to the circlesanctuary.org/circlegreen. It's all good. And until next time, this is Char Bear signing off. Thank you for all the good you do. Stay true and blue. And hey, hope to see you in the green space.